What's up, everybody? Welcome to the CaliCast. I'm Uriah Faber, the California Kid. Be spitting some knowledge, telling stories, and having a good time. Welcome back to MMAU under the CaliCast. Today we have Tuss from Australia here, looking cute today.
Yep. I don't even know what to say. I'm like, yes.
You just sit there and look cute. That's it. That's funny. I remember one of the first stories you told me when you moved out here from Australia was how your dad wasn't going to let you fight because he said, you got to protect your face.
He told me I was too pretty. And I was like, this is some bullshit. Because my fighting family, my brother was fighting from 13, and then eventually I wanted to fight. My little brother wanted to fight. But then it was like, you're too pretty, but you may as well, everyone else has. And I was like, okay, let's do it.
So that'll get us into what we're going to talk about today. So MMAU, we're talking about a lot of different things. Last time we talked about credit and how some fighters may or may not know some basic fundamental things about life, which is building your credit, etc. We had Jason Bartlett, Bartlett on. But we're going to touch on everything under mixed martial arts. And in this episode in particular, we're going to talk about the Muay Thai portion of mixed martial arts. Mixed martial arts is exactly that. It's a mix of anything you can do to win a fight. And one of the most dominant aspects of mixed martial arts has been, without a doubt, Muay Thai kickboxing, boxing, but in particular the Muay Thai portion, the eight limbs. And for those that don't know, Tuss has become part of our team as a transport from Australia. She grew up in a super combat heavy family, and so I'll let her get into that in a little bit. But she has a perspective, and what we're going to talk about today is a really interesting part about our sport, which is the different parts that make it up and how those sports on their own are brought upon, you know, athletes, how the economics of it work, how the living situations work, just basically an inside look, open book to the lifestyle of martial arts, but in this case, Muay Thai. So give us a quick background. You're from Australia, but what's your family history?
From Australia, Perth, Western Australia. My mom and dad actually were probably like the pioneers in Australian Muay Thai. My dad last year just got inducted to the Australian Muay Thai Hall of Fame for that.
Nice. Shout out so, right there.
So
Australian Hall of Fame for Muay Thai?
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. I think my brother's born in 88 and the gym and whatnot was founded in 89.
What's the name of the gym?
Pond's Gym, but he has like Australian Muay Thai promotions. So back in the day, we had like fight promotions and shows at the big casinos. We were sponsored by like Thai Airways. She actually worked at the casino. She speaks Thai. She's from New Zealand.
And you speak Thai, right?
Yep.
Give us one little blurb here.
A little blurb. Yeah. Chantu tasana ayu yipka kwab.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
So with that, my mom, when she worked at the casino, she got to meet the Thai players who are obviously like the more wealthy. And with that there, they kind of got to connect and they opened a Muay Thai gym. My dad had competed
what
as
year
a
was
child.
This?
It's before I was born. So like the 80s, 90s.
Okay.
So yeah, with that, they got all the connections in Thailand because as we'll talk about the culture back in the day was very heavy on the government, kind of like upper class. Through that, they ended up opening a gym, started doing promotions, and luckily via that like kind of outlet, we were able to go back and forth between Thailand and Perth, which is actually 6.5-7 hours away. So very, what should I say, like, I'm very lucky that like our culture was truly embedded.
Multicultural.
Yeah, multicultural. Yeah, we got to see like the real, our heritage, and then as well as that, the sport that comes with it, which is truly embedded in Thai culture.
That's cool. And now, is this true? For those that don't know, Adam Corrigan, one of our longtime Team Alpha Male, also an import from Australia. You guys are now great friends in both parts of the team. But he actually fought back in the day when he had hair, mind you.
And in track pants. So before, funnily enough, before MMA was a thing, my dad on his fight promotions did style versus style, like combat. So he would do Muay Thai versus Kung Fu, Taekwondo, but with modified rules.
Pioneer,
because MMA
like that.
Wasn't that. And it was in the ring. Adam wore track pants. He actually fought our main fighter at the time, Raymond Skopanovich. He beat him.
Wow, Adam.
Raymond came
we
overweight.
We all thought you were joking, man.
My brother cornered him in the corner. And then that was 2003, I think. And then 2013, 10 years later, I met him at the gym covering a Muay Thai class. And that was my first month in the United States.
You met him at our gym.
Yeah.
Man, it's been 10 years, huh?
Yeah.
Wow, what year did you come out to our team? And what was kind of the history of you moving out here? I can't.
I originally was doing a study exchange, and I wanted to do an exchange in California, and the only California university was Sacramento. And then I was fighting at the time, and your gym was the closest gym for me to ride my bike from the dorms at Sac State.
Nice.
So, and then I did a few classes, and then there was Veronica at the time, Paige, and Cynthia had just moved, and then there wasn't very many girls at the time, so I was told that if I'd fought and wanted to, I could jump into pro practice. So,
nice.
Yeah.
And so, now, did you have the misconception about California that everyone does? Like, you're going to get to California and you're going to be by the ocean and see movie stars and all that kind of stuff? Or were you pretty in reality with Sacramento?
I had
Northern
no
California?
Idea about Sacramento, what to expect. I
we're
was just like, California.
Here.
Yeah. But everything was close. So, ocean's not as close, obviously. It's not quite as, like,
it's
Perth
not too
is
bad.
On the coast.
An hour
yeah.
or so, but it's cold ocean. It's not,
yeah, it's not
what
Perth
you'd see
ocean.
In the movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or in Perth, yeah.
And I didn't really know what to expect. I was supposed to go and do a second semester in Missouri, and that fell through, so I just stayed.
Oh, she loved
And then that,
that
was when I ended up just, like, staying, and yeah. I did as much school as I could, and then as much training as I could.
Right.
So.
And really gotten better with our team, and, you know, you'll get to know Tess. She's a sweetheart and also goes above and beyond. So back to the Muay Thai world. You are in a super unique situation. You have a Thai father and a Thai stepfather too,
mm-hmm.
right? And
yep.
and that's kind of its own little story.
But yeah.
Let's get into, all right, we've established that you're an expert in this. I mean, you
essentially.
Know.
Now I'm like MMA infused.
You're MMA infused.
I've had the last 7 years of being like mixed martial arts, which has been great to see because you see, for me, UFC, like my favorite fighter was Jose Aldo. He's like stunning, like
oh,
Muay Thai
fighter. Oh, that's
cold-hearted,
man. Battered my leg. That was messed up. And poor Chad. I won't tell Chad. Don't watch this.
No,
man.
Like at the start, that was how I like knew that I was like, oh shit, like it translates further into that. So
yeah. And today's day and age, we've got Israel De Los Anjos or
Adesanya. Yeah,
I can't. Izzy's amazing, and we have you know, Anderson Silva, and the list goes on of these incredible.
Yeah, like even the girls, Shevchenko.
Yeah,
like
incredible stand up. So the most interesting part for me, and when I look into this, I mean, this is a super old sport. Fighting in general, as everybody knows, is, I mean, that's what the cavemen were doing, to fight over chicks and fight over food and who's going to sleep
status.
In what cave and whatnot. But Muay Thai as a sport, and I read that, I think in 2006 maybe, they had to change it to Muay Thai as one word versus Muay Thai two words, because they to make it an official world class sport, they couldn't have a culture
and
country in the name, so they had to make it Muay Thai one word.
Yeah.
And but it dates back, like, documented into the 1600s with the kings kind of making it their pastime and making it a priority, health, fitness, awareness, but then it later came to be, you know, one of the biggest parts of the culture, right?
Definitely. Like there's a national day in March, Naikonom Thom Day, which is it's this like story in history. He was captive between, I'm pretty sure it was like Thailand and Burma. They had war. He had to fight for his freedom, so he fought, impressed the king. He sent him off on his way with his freedom and like concubines, and got to fight. He fought like hundreds of men. It's also the national sport of Thailand, as well as like all the army service people. They have to learn Muay Thai as one of the next like combat. Hand-to-hand combat for when you don't have a weapon. So
that's I wouldn't want to face that army.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it'd be up for debate. You put a bunch of wrestlers. You go to the Greek.
Yeah, the Greek.
All wrestlers versus the Muay Thai. That'd be a nasty showdown. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'd probably lean towards wrestling in the very end, but you know, I could be biased. I don't know.
Maybe just a little. So yeah, the sport's super old. It's it's kind of getting its a bigger spotlight now because of mixed martial arts, which is super cool. And the UFC is working pretty hard to try and get into that culture in Thailand.
Right. And they, you know, I think it kind of was at a peak, maybe early 2000s, where Muay Thai fighters were getting paid, you know, a lot of cash to compete.
Internationally, they got like a good platform with K1. Borkal was actually one of like the top fighters fighting.
Borkal Porpromukh.
Yeah. He's actually probably one of the biggest names to help spotlight the sport on the international playing field with the K1, as well as like...
They said the popularity was kind of at its height, 1980s, 1990s. Top fighters could command purses of over 200,000 baht.
And
the stadia were gambling. They drew big gates, etc. What is 200,000 baht? Approximately. You don't have to give us the direct.
Approximately like $1 US, I think, works out to like 30 baht. But that's a lot of money. 30 baht can feed you in Thailand on the street.
Right,
you know?
Even today, right?
Yeah, even today. So like Thailand, they actually like what keeps the sport afloat too within Thailand is the gambling.
Yeah.
It's a big gambling sport. And I think
a gambling problem really is what it is.
Like I've been there and there's two main stadiums. Lumpini Stadium they've just recently in the last, I think, 10 years, they built a new stadium, but the original Lumpini Stadium in Bangkok was a tiny shed, but it was the most prestigious place to fight in the world. Their second stadium is Rajanam Dern Stadium. Also very prestigious to fight there. They were the two main places, but like if you walk in there and you lose a fight and the bets go via round, I've seen people throw glass bottles at you as you leave, like all the patrons.
Really?
Yeah, if the fighter loses and they bet all their money, they're like throwing glass bottles and cans. I think they banned glass like recently.
That's awesome.
I think they said it was like $140 billion like betting per year.
Yeah, they
like,
said
on that.
They say if it weren't for the gambling portion of Muay Thai, it probably would not be existing anymore. I mean, that's kind of what drives it
exactly.
Economy-wise. And they say, 40 billion baht
which
a
is
year
a lot there.
In gambling with
I think
with
that's
there.
Like 1.3 million U.S. for
that's
a third
it?
World country. Well,
oh
for there,
God.
That's a lot of money. Because there's
a lot of gambling,
in the sports, it's like the good mafia like essentially cover
the good mafia.
Yeah,
okay. Expand on that. What does that mean?
There's like the good, the bad mafia. The good mafia, they kind of oversee like horse racing, dog racing, Muay Thai, and then the other side is probably like the sex industry, the drugs.
I mean,
kind of thing.
That's
so,
no joke. The sex industry is massive.
Yeah,
I mean, that's probably the biggest thing there, right?
Yeah, but like Muay Thai and the gambling and betting up on that side is up on the totem pole with that. So it just kind of shows you the industry differences to like what we have here, where you have sports bet, my sports, like all
right.
Those different things to, yeah, like live fights, live gambling by round. Like it's insane.
Yeah. And one of the most, and I want to go into, because this is part of, for the MMAU, I want to talk about how the economics work and how the lifestyle works for the fighters. But before that, just talk about, it's a hot topic. It's something that is, you know, debatable, but I mean, it's not really debatable. It's fact. It's super dangerous. Some of these kids start fighting at 4 and 5 years old,
yeah,
like really actually fighting where their fights are worth money, where their parents are. I mean, how does that work? Do they get dropped off? Do they volunteer? I mean, I've got my daughter's almost 2, and I can imagine 2 years sending her off to go be a fighter.
Just dropping her off at a camp.
I mean, although her favorite thing to do is now hold her fist up and give a look, and we say, don't hit, you're not allowed to hit. She like
Callie's
really intimidates.
Savage.
Yeah, she's savage. She's got that from her mom, I think.
Not her dad.
Yeah, no, not a bit.
So I guess essentially...
And these kids start...
They start... So Thailand, it's a poor country, third world country.
Right.
And in
and
the
so you
culture,
you said 30 bahts, about $1, and that could feed you for a day.
It could feed you a meal. Like that's like you going on the street and getting enough to eat happily. But that is probably what some kids probably make a day, like working over there. I'm not too sure, 100%. So don't quote me on that. But like, generally speaking, in terms of going to a camp, in Thai culture, you always look after your elders, kind of give back to your parents for what they've done and sacrifice for you. So typically what would happen is you'd have a few fights in your, like, most fighters come from small villages or the outskirts. They're not in the city. They'll start and they have, most cities and towns have temples. So they do Muay Wat, which is like temple fights, whether it's like fight shows there, and you probably fight for like 30 baht. And if you win, a little kid wins that. So you kind of fight and you have a few little fights there. Probably your dad trains you in the backyard or with a bag, some old gloves. And then when there's kind of some potential and the parents think, okay, like my kid can go on with this, the parents will generally take their kids to a renowned camp or just a closer camp. And then they'll be like, this is my kid, this is my record. Will you be willing to take on my child into your camp? And it's kind of like a business proposition, like the...
Almost like selling the kid's services, basically.
Yeah, so you...
But they're saying, hey, we'll invest in your kid.
Yeah, you're saying that you're going to invest in my kid.
Man, so this in perspective, and I'll let you finish, I don't mean to cut you off, but just knowing what we know about parents here in the U.S. and how some are super delusional.
Yeah.
And obviously everyone sees the potential in their own kids, but then also having the levels of different types of coaching that you can get. I mean, holy smokes, you could have the wrong parent with the wrong kid in the wrong camp and that kid is doomed.
Yeah, well, like that's essentially
you get dropped. Sure, it happens.
Yeah, and then as you get better, you can either try and proposition go to another camp, or a promoter will come and be like,
at that point, can you, like, the kids get traded, like, or how would you go about
back
shifting?
In the day,
because if someone's investing, you know, they're giving you basically food, training, and housing.
They send you to school as well.
Okay.
So the promoter or the gym owner will generally send you to school too. You finish school, you come back, you train. You train before school, you go to school, you come back. Your meals are provided. You have your housing. So when that comes to that, that's kind of where I'm not so much sure now, but in the olden days, they would like buy you, like send you off and kind of do a trade, or they can buy your fight. And then in Muay Thai, you get given a fight name. And then your last name to your fight name is your fight camp. So, right.
Like Fairtex, for example, he's
the
current like best guy in the world.
Yotsenkly Fairtex.
Yeah, and I've seen him fight.
Yeah,
that guy's amazing. He's got the last name Fairtex, which is obviously the name of the gym. But he's must have been the kid that got the most food.
he's a little chunker.
He started you know, shining from a young age, had some talents, and became the guy that is doing really well.
Yeah. So as well as
what,
like,
is that, how does that affect his life? As he gets, like, they see potential in this young kid because he's beating up the other kids. Does he get more food? Does he get the bigger room? Does he get more?
You essentially just sleep all in the same room. I know Fairtex because in 2010, I was like doing my gap year after high school, and I actually went out and stayed at Fairtex and trained out there. They are like a more upscale, they've been ahead of the fight game in business and materializing like the Western influence of people coming to pay to train.
Right.
So with that, like, they've got their own rooms versus some of the smaller gyms inside
the
city.
But like he still lives a humble life, right?
Yeah. He actually does. He actually just got married. So
wow, congratulations.
So, yeah, like he has a humble life. He's still got like his own room, but it's just his. It's probably no bigger than a hotel room. Like, same thing. You get your own shower, bathroom. But in the smaller camps, you're all sleeping in a huge room. No one has a bed. It's like a little rollout mattress. You all sleep pretty much, everyone like cuddles together. I think John Wayne Parr's actually put some photos out. You're all in like probably a room as big as this. You all have... There's no showers. They have like buckets where you throw water on each other. You're out in the alleyway doing that. Feeding time is when the head, like, gym kind of supervisor is cooking up a meal, or like the, they call it makua, like the mother of the kitchen or the camp. She'll cook up some food and they all eat together. It's like a huge family.
Which can be good, but can also be pretty bad. You get some bad apples in there, you know, the bad uncle or the bully kid or whatever is going on. I'm sure you learn to live in that community and, you know, learn about life.
I feel like it's got a lot better now as, like, the Western influence coming to train out there. My brother was living that dream back
in
the 2000s.
Honestly, you know, I talked to Orion and Louis Cosi. They have a trainer that is recently moved up to Northern California. And Dr. Blackburn, and he actually lived out in Thailand and experienced this whole lifestyle. I want to have him on this show at some point and talk about his knowledge and experience. But he was saying he got to take a look at Bukow, who was one of the top guys in the world for a long time, and eventually made some good segue and made some decent money himself. But he stayed throughout his whole career in his camp in like just like a shanty of a room, really.
So funny story about Bukow. So when you go to a gym, it's kind of like having a manager. They take their percentage cut. I think it was like
most of the money.
Well, it's supposed to be like 30-70. I guess the camp takes 30, which then gets to like the gym owner.
Uh-huh.
And then it gets spread out to trainers, that portion. But Bukow, in his heyday, hitting K1. He was fighting like Masato. I think he won the K1 championship. His promoter, his gym owner and his like manager per se, was giving him his cuts, but all of a sudden had mansions being built, and he ended up like taking Bukow's money, and they had to go to like the head of the authority and negotiate it out. He ended up leaving and opening his own gym, but he still has to pay money to the Paul Pramuk gym and owner for him to make his own segue. Wow. And like leave that. So it's like very business orientated too.
Right.
And he was also went on like a hiatus and just like disappeared, and that's probably the first fighter that Thailand actually cared about and was like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
Like, they were like, you need to mediate it and make it right. So he's not under Paul Pramuk anymore, but I'm pretty certain he still has to pay something like 15 or 20% to them on any fight he does now in future, just to pay his dues of like them bringing him up, even though they like took
his
money.
Because I heard that he had opened his own gym, and you know, it's on
a pig farm, like right on the river next to a pig farm. That says it's like gross, but
his new one.
Yeah, but it's in his hometown, yeah. and he's doing his thing.
So we've got our own success story out of Team Alpha Male with Master Tong. You know, yeah. I remember, you know, Master Tong's story was he came over. He became the number one. He was, first off, he fought at the highest level in kickboxing, started as a little kid, has some genetic gifts, etc. And you know more about Tong because, I mean, he was my trainer for 11 years, and I understood, you know, we had a way of communicating, but he didn't speak any English. But you always knew, like, a little peek inside, which wasn't apparently not much different from what I was getting.
No,
anyways.
It was exactly what you were all getting. You all thought he had some different persona. I was like, no, everything he says to you about how amazing he is, he tells me in Thai.
Yeah, meanwhile, he'd be drinking the generic Mountain Dew and smoking cigarettes and training people all freaking day. I mean, talk about mental toughness.
Yeah.
That dude would go all day. He'd go out, have a cigarette break, drink his soda, and then he'd come in and just go, you know, 45-minute session with me, then one with TJ, then with Chad Mendes, then with Joseph Benavidez, and then the next guy, and the next guy. I mean, that guy really – and it makes sense now of his work ethic. He was living a life out here making money like he never could in his own home country.
Yeah.
And he was sending money back to his family. He was on the phone. I remember when we finally got video phones back and forth, how that changed his life. But he was on the phone at all times talking to his son, who he didn't get to see for 10, 11 years, and talking to his wife and going through their own dramas. And this happened and that happened. And Tandy got, you know, awarded the best looking kid at the school. And then now Tandy jumped off the thing and he's injured. And he was always hurting his leg and this and that. But at the end of the day, when it was all wrapped up here, it was kind of an emotional adios to Master Tong. I remember driving to the airport,
right?
The train station, and we were both crying and stuff. And he was just so scared about going back home. But at this point, he's had, you know, got back. He's one of the few guys that made his own small gym and now is upgraded to a better gym. And it seems like he's doing pretty well.
It looks like it, yeah. He's in Bangkok, has his own gym. It's modern. So like most gyms are kind of like run down. They're probably a lot better now. I haven't been back since 2015, 5 years. But his gym is indoors, fresh, like mats,
yeah, it looks
ring.
Nice.
It looks really nice.
He's got some like Thai celebrities coming
he
in.
He has,
there.
Yeah. That's a cool thing in Thailand now is that the sport's not just for like the hardcore fighters. Now the celebrities are getting on board. I think there's one of my friends, Matthew Dean. He is a pop star. His wife is a really famous pop star. And he was kind of one of the first gym owners to be like a celebrity versus like a promoter or like hardcore gym owner that's been in the game for years. So kind of bringing the famous people in and mixing that up, which is cool.
Yeah. And I, you know, I had a chance to meet some of Master Tong's new students when I was out in Singapore with Sage last time.
Oh, nice.
And, Super cool. They love him. They said, you know, he's grown. I was going to fly him over to Singapore because that was right when I was going to make my comeback to fight. And he just said he was too busy because he had to run his only – him and his son. And his son is helping him run the gym now. And it's pretty cool to hear how it kind of would have been. How does it work for those trainers that are in Thailand that live there? And maybe they're the top trainer, maybe they're not. Like Master Tong was actually Bukow's boxing trainer for a bit, and he trained multiple world champions for boxing. He came over with a boxing team to the U.S. and then – was a stowaway in Vegas and ended up living here for 11 like years 11 as years. A stowaway and made a better life for himself. But what is it like for those trainers that are living in those camps?
Essentially, though, like the trainers are the fighters. So the life cycle is you come in as a kid, you're on your peak, and you either stay or go to another gym. And then full circle, you become a trainer and you coach that there. You either have enough of that lifestyle and move home to be with your family, like Master Tong, 10 years here. I remember when he was leaving, he was telling me in Thai that it was like, it scared him because for the first time you were his family and he put his heart and soul into your guys' the beginning of your career. He was there for the fruition to the peak. Mm-hmm. And now it was time for him to go back and be with his family. So essentially they will either stay in the camps, continue to be trainers, or eventually just move home and find other ways to work and go back because they leave their families. They support their families, whether that's just their wife.
Do they make a decent living, those trainers in Thailand, or is
they get like a monthly pay from the trainer, from like the gym owner, but that also comes from purses. There's probably sponsorship money now because I know a lot of that comes in. And then international training, you do one-on-one sessions, you make money like that. Right. So it's kind of a workhorse mentality from a kid to like all the way through.
Yeah, they're just grinding.
Yeah.
And Master Tong, I'll always say that about him. He had little quirks about him that some people could or could not handle. He knew whether he was being done right or wrong, and I feel like he always kept in good terms with the guys that he felt were treating him correctly.
I remember everyone asked me, like, does your dad gamble and drink and smoke? And I was like, I think he might be the only Thai man I know who doesn't do all of those. He's like the opposite.
Yeah.
So yeah, I know he had his quirks. He was a crazy guy.
But I'm so happy to see him. I mean, he really... I mean, that's a hard life when you know that there's nothing back home to really get ahead.
Yeah.
And he took that risk, came here through really hard work and great personality and being really a master of his craft, you know, was able to provide for himself and create an opportunity. And now he's living a better life out there. So much love to Master Tong. So my question goes, okay, look, I've been in this sport of mixed martial arts, and I would say probably the closest thing, because mixed martial arts is so new, we don't have a history like that dates back to the 1600s, that is just like our sport, etc.
93, right?
Yeah, 93. I mean, of course, fighting, whatever. But wrestling is somewhat similar in the fact that
it's got a long history.
It's got a long history, and you have guys that have started when they're very young. And I just on our own team throughout the years, Lance Palmer, TJ Dillashaw, Chad. Cody Garbrandt, Chad Mendez, those are guys that started wrestling when they were 4 and 5 years old. They had crazy dads that were not necessarily, you know, trying to make money off their kid, but they just
wanted
had an ego and wanted success, and they wanted their kids to be the best. And they would put them in these tournaments and groom them from a young age to be these warriors. So, you know, it's funny because you see Muay Thai and wrestling is two of the top disciplines in our sport, and I think it's because of that. There's literally not many other sports. I would say boxing does a pretty good job, but it's just too one-dimensional to make as much of an impact as a Muay Thai or wrestling background. But you have two different disciplines that have roots in children that devote their lives to it, and they become experts, not only technically, but mentally, physically, and it's like a lifetime warrior. It's like the modern day gladiator.
Lifestyle.
And so, today's day and age, you're seeing those two backgrounds have a dominance.
Great success.
And now the new generation, they have to, if they want to. And we've got it on our own team: Andrew Coyne, our Bulldog, and Bopo, and Corey McKenna, and these young new generation. They're doing the same thing with mixed martial arts, but not necessarily out of a means. Like we talked about Thailand, we're getting kids that are, you know, take it from their village. Hey, can you house them and feed them and teach them how to fight and flip a coin and hope they like it and they don't get beat down. They're not the one that's – they're the hammer, not the nail. And maybe they become the top guy in the facility. But I feel like when mixed martial arts starts becoming that in other parts of the country that are you know – third world, we're going to start seeing some amazing fighters out of that side.
You look
of the world.
At like Brazil, I feel is super similar to Thailand. Some of their best Muay Thai fighters, you look at that, like they're coming out of the favelas, they're coming out of like rough upbringings. Like,
and we're going to, and this today's episode, the MMAU is purely about the Muay Thai influence culture, on MMA, but we're going to do wrestling, we're going to do jiu-jitsu and some of the other disciplines, some judo and whatnot as well. But like you're saying, it's real similar there.
Yeah, it just shows that like the roots kind of similar in the successes of the discipline in different areas. So just knowing as well, like you don't really have as many, I feel like, in the Western world, the distractions of like you're put on a path and you're like, okay, this is where I'm going, and you're off. Like, what's it, Figueiredo? He was saying that he was in an apartment with his sister growing up with no power and no running water. So you're like, well, that's like that drive of like a drive and a want, as well as like the training and the hard work.
Yeah, and now you have social media, and you have the ability to like obtain knowledge from all over and also see what other people are doing that you think, hey, I could be doing that. I could beat that person up, is which all these fighters should be thinking. Like,
definitely.
You know, and so it's creating a whole new dynamic with throughout the world. But, you know, one of the most interesting aspects for me on the Muay Thai side is how the structure of the facility. So it's basically, look, somebody has become the owner of the gym. And then it's like an ecosystem within it where it's the success of the gym depends on the success of the fighters. And so then you really have to figure out what works best, because we want to create great fighters. Yeah. Unless you're the guys that are always like, because I heard there's a lot of corruption over there, people throwing fights, etc. But you know, there's a real incentive to say, hey, our gym needs to protect our fighters. They probably have to take into account the mental side of it. Like, you don't want to have a bad environment where people are all upset to be there. You got to have
a good environment,
or else you're going to see the result.
It's pretty gangster over there too. Like, I've been to one of the fights at Lumpini Stadium, and the odds were against one of my friends who was fighting. They took us out the back, and the promoters and like Lumpini Stadium like managers were like, the odds are so far stacked against you. If you lose this fight, we'll take you out the back and like shoot you on the head. Like, that's how bad, like there's that much money on this. And it's the same, like that trickles down into the gym of having good people that you can trust that aren't going to be going and putting out like feelers out to the betting people or other camps. Like, it's a different, more, it's, I get what you're saying, it's also like a hardcore element to it too, because it is corrupt.
Well, I mean, the value
of money is so much higher in a
the value stakes. Of life is so much lower in those places also. I mean, when you're talking about basically prostitution, male and female prostitution, lady boys, you know, everything under the sun, and then fighting are two of the main incomes of the whole country, it just makes for a really weird dynamic. I remember Master Tong explaining to me just like a lesson in the value of the life in Thailand. He was saying, look, a little kid, you could pay a little kid who doesn't understand what death is necessarily to go shoot someone. Like, you'd be like, hey, I'll give you this. You could take a newspaper. He said one time a kid just took a newspaper, moved the newspaper, boom, shot someone. And they got his money, and nothing happened, you know?
it's crazy.
I mean, I'm sure it's changed now. Yeah. I don't know if it has or not.
I feel like there's still something. Like, when I was a kid and we're going to Thailand, it was always stay close, don't leave. Like, you see the little kids begging on the corner with, like, missing limbs. You're like, there are gangs that, like, snatch kids up, like, hurt them and put them on the street to beg for money. Like, it's not just people who are actually
what's
begging
that,
for
what's
the
sake of making. What's that? The movie about India where they cut the guy's
Slumdog
eyes out.
Slumdog Millionaire, is that one?
Yeah, Slumdog Millionaire.
Like, that's a reality there. So
there's some
like,
corrupt people in this world. Yeah, it's scary.
It's the reality in that country, and I feel like as negative it can be, like Muay Thai kind of brings that up to you're an athlete, you give back, you support your family.
There's bad people, but there's a lot of good that's come out of it as well.
Yeah.
I was reading a little bit about, you know, the arguments against the kids fighting.
So young.
And Well, there's no doubt that, you know, getting hit in the head over and over again when your brain's developing is bad. I mean, it's bad enough when you're a fully developed brain. You know, I didn't start actually sparring until I was like 24. And your brain, I think, is just about done like right around that time. Yeah, 24, 25. And I wasn't doing a ton of it. But you take kids who are starting very, very young, and there's a lot at stake. You know, you're providing for your own family and then the new adopted family. And then you're inside an environment where it is better to be the best. You get more attention. You probably get more love. You get more positive interaction from being the kid that's the top dog. Yeah. You're also at the better side of a sparring session, which is happening a lot. They said, let me see, look at this real quick. It said, children often start practicing Muay Thai performing around the age of 5. That means the stakes are high and you're not thinking about anything but trying to win.
Yeah.
Trying to win at that point.
Because you have the pressure of like winning and feeding your family. It's not like you're winning and you get this purse and you're going to go to the candy store and buy yourself a few chocolate bars. Like you're feeding your family, like mom, dad, grandparents, because your parents are probably looking after your grandparents over there.
Right.
It's a lot of pressure. And then, as you mentioned too, the physical attributes of development too.
Yeah.
Which like from that lifestyle cycle starting at 5, and then most of the time the trainers like to gamble and smoke and drink, and that becomes a habit because they had like hardcore habits of training. You take that away, they need outlet. So
yeah, I've met, you know, with Master Tong being at the gym, I've met a bunch of his Thai buddies throughout the years. I remember one was a Thai fighter, but then he became a professional boxer, was a high level boxer, and his brain was like gone. And they would joke about it. Like Master Tong would say, "Hey, you know,"
like they say, "Mom Mike," which means like also, punch drunk.
Yeah, punch drunk. Yeah. And
it's a real thing.
Yeah, like, it's like a real thing, especially if you're like a lifetime fighter who's done that nothing but that. And then he was good enough to become a boxer where it's just punches to the head.
Yeah,
that's even more so than the other strikes. So they said in 2016, 9,998 children under the age of 15 were registered with the board boxing under the Sport Authority of Thailand.
And that's like the kids that are like fighting in like decent promotions that need to be registered. What they're like the fight shows at the temples where you're just like backyard, like that's how they're getting to get paid to start.
Yeah. And they say that the child boxers for sure sustain brain injury. I mean, there's no mystery about that, but they also have lower IQs, about 10 points lower on average. And the lower the IQ usually correlates with how long they've been training. So, you know, IQ is an important thing, obviously, you know, but if you're going to have a lifetime of fighting, I mean, it's probably not as important, but give me a break. When you're talking about, you know, a guy who's a new father, and I can think of, you know, I have a boy and a girl. One's, you know, possibly going to go into one profession, one possibly going to another profession.
You want the best.
In Thailand, it's like, that's a scary prospect, even being born into that. You know what I mean?
It's like it's a fast route to kind of like, fast route to put your kids into that and get, it's not a fast route in that you get money straight away, but it's essentially, it will start small and hopefully fruition into bigger money, bigger dollars for bigger fights.
Yeah.
But still a crazy thing.
Yeah.
I've spoken to fighters in Thailand. I'm like, what do you think about, like, you ever worry about your body? And like, well, we're not going to do anything else. I don't have any other aspirations. So to me, it doesn't matter as long as I can fight. But that's like that one dimensional thought of,
yeah,
it's the only thing I'm going to do.
Yeah. And I mean, there's that obviously. And I don't want this discussion to be all about the terrors of child fighting. But it is interesting to know, like, look, you see a guy like Fairtex, who's like amazing, like on a different level of fighting than maybe an American that has come on. And I mean, it's really hard to match up with even the Dutch, who have a strong Muay Thai background, and the Dutch kickboxing, or the Americans that have done it. It's hard to replace a world with no rules for little kids with so much on stake and on the line versus somebody that thinks it might be fun in America, catches the bug, becomes a little obsessed, and gets really good. I mean, there's a huge level of difference from a guy that is just a pure weapon with nothing else in his life except for that his whole life. And you'll see that at the highest level, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how different is the skew of talent at the highest level in Thailand? I mean, can anyone compare with the Thais?
I mean, they have, it's called King's Cup. This is like more so amateurs. This is where you see like the Joanna, I can't say her last name.
Jaworszczyk?
Yeah, Joanna and then Shevchenko. So it's called like the Princess Cup, the King's Cup. They're the amateurs. You're padded up, but you're having like, you can have up, it's a round robin competition. And that's where the Russians come through. They're hardcore.
Yeah,
and
they I was going to talk about the Russians.
The Polish.
Yeah.
So like my brother competed at like 15 through high school and he would be like, there's nothing worse than drawing a tie, but what's worse than drawing a tie to fight is the Russians. Or like, you know, like
drawing a tie. Okay.
Yeah, because it's a like round robin, so they draw you out of a
your
weight class.
Oh, the Russians are beasts.
And he'll be like, I don't know what's better, like getting a tie or a Russian. There's nothing better. So they kind of level up, and they've been going to Thailand to fight and compete for before anybody else, the Americans, kind of thing. So,
this is a good story because, and we've got on our own team actually fighting. In a couple days here, Slava Borshov for LFA. But in Russia, back when it was Russia, it was the USSR, I think they're able to separate kids based on a hunch, you know, like or a family history or whatever, and put them in one direction and be like, you're going to be a boxer, you're going to be a wrestler, and then they just focus on that, which is another thing where it's like kind of inhumane, but created one of the best, you know, athletic stretches of all different countries. And I remember my coach Lenny Zaleski, who's my wrestling coach in college at UC Davis, he coached with Dan Gable and was coached by Dan Gable, but he said he went to a big tournament called Tbilisi, and I think I've talked about this before. Tbilisi would only allow one placer from each country, and so he took second in Tbilisi, but 1 through 9 was actually all Russians. And so he took second, but he really took ninth.
Yeah.
But because only one Russian could be crowned, he was second. So that kind of put things in perspective. When you become obsessive about something, and this is a good lesson for the listeners out there that want to understand, like, first off, how can I make a living in something if I'm getting a late start, or even if I'm passionate about it right now as a younger kid? You have to healthfully have an obsession, and that means not necessarily obsession, but a work. There's a couple different things. Obsession would be great, but you don't choose obsession. Either you're obsessed or you're not. I remember BJ Penn telling me that, you know, he was the first ever American Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu champion. He did it in 3-4 years, and he said he was obsessed. He couldn't go to sleep without thinking this goes to that, goes to this, goes to that. And he doesn't choose that.
I feel like that's like the greats. You look at Kobe Bryant. He's the same thing. He's like, I'll wake up. I find a way to do it regardless. Like,
yes.
I train once my kids are asleep so I can be there. It's like,
And there's the obsession, which, like I said, you don't get to choose that. Maybe you'll get lucky, and maybe it's lucky or unlucky, depending how you look at it. Maybe you'll get lucky, get obsessed with our sport and trying to make that last. Now, the problem comes if you don't have the other pieces in place. Because I've seen guys in a garage get obsessed, get really good at something, watch things, learn from people, train more than the other person, get stronger, get in great shape. But if you don't have the work ethic to match, you don't even need work ethic when you're obsessed. You don't even think it's work. You're just going.
Doing it.
I remember joking with BJ Penn about that because, you know, his latter part of his career wasn't as great as the beginning of his career. And I think that was part of it. When he wasn't obsessed, it wasn't as much of a
I don't think you get the name prodigy with that, you know.
So obsession is great, but at some point that's got to wear off. Or otherwise you retire early, etc. And you don't even need obsession to be the best at something.
Just dedication. Obsession
forces you into a life of repetition, a life of full involvement, and a life of full commitment, which is what you see in champions. But you can do the same with a love for something, not an obsession, with the right work ethic, the right environment, the right coaching, the right mentors. You can get to the highest level. But it's like cheating the system when you become obsessed. So luckily, some guys have gotten obsessed in our room, and most of the time those guys have become world champs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so let's take it back to your family dynamic. Your dad was a pioneer in the Australian world for martial arts.
Yeah, a good chunk of time.
For Muay Thai. Your brothers were all involved in the sport.
Yeah.
What are some different ways that you can, because I was, when I talked about this in my book way back in the day. Look, you had a passion for fighting. You wanted to fight. Now you are around fighting. You're involved in fighting. It's like a
daily thing. I still train.
You still train and everything else. But you've found out a way to make a lifestyle that involves it, which helps you, you know, make a career on top of being involved in something you love. What are some things in the Muay Thai world that you could do if you're not, if you figure out, well, I don't have the chops to be the pro fighter. What could you do? You could do what? You could start a gym.
You could start a gym. A lot of work. Yeah. You can work with athletes because, one, you understand the sport itself, right, what you have to put yourself through on a daily side. I don't mean like full-fledged manager, but you can work with like partnerships, community.
I guess you can even do refereeing. You could be coaching.
You can do coaching. Like at one point, I was an instructor at the gym when I first moved back. So when I came back and you guys sponsored my visa, I was coaching. There's lots of little avenues. Like for me, at one point, I even considered like, do I want to work with like the UFC? There's now promotions. Not so much. UFC is probably pretty big here. There's lots of higher end, lower tier promotions there. Yeah. I feel like right now in the current climate in the Western world, especially in the US, there's a lot of opportunities to find a way, whether you're coaching, you're working with athletes like on the side.
Yeah. I mean, in our gym alone, if I think about it and dissect it, because like, you know, MMAU is taking a look at our sport. If you want to be involved
as a fighter,
but just things that, it's almost like school for somebody that wants to be involved in our sport.
And that's the thing about martial arts. It's like you give back or you go back. You're within it to an extent.
Yeah, absolutely. So in our gym, we have people that work the front desk. We have people that are janitors. I have not had a janitorial staff member that has not
worked at the gym.
Has not wanted to train. Right, they're in there doing that job because it puts them in an environment where they get to train.
Like Joseph Benavidez, he was like mopping the mats.
Joseph Benavidez working the front desk, mopping mats, alongside me, who's the owner of the gym. But you know, there's sales guys selling memberships. There's instructors within the gym. There's multiple people. Road Dog's a good example.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Richardson. He's a journalist.
He's a journalist. On top of being a fighter, on top of now he's coaching at one of my gyms and also assistant coaching me because he knows all of my stuff on some of the technical side of things. There's a lot of ways to get involved in your sport.
Yeah. There's like YouTube now. You can blog. People are blogging about fashion. If you're already in the sports realm and you know people from fighting, that's another way. Technique, fundamentals, basics. So.
Right. But let's bring this back full circle before we wrap it up and just say the lesson that I've taken from an insight, and I'm glad we didn't do a pre-interview with this because I was like, hey, let's just save it for the interview.
Yeah.
Because I had a bunch of questions that I wasn't sure of, but I wanted to know. Why are the Thais such experts, along with the Russians, in the Muay Thai? And the answer is full commitment. Whether it's forced, out of necessity.
Survival,
that's one thing. But I know plenty of people that have taken that same mentality of I have to, or I need to, or I'm going to, and applied it to getting really good really quick. And anybody can do that, really. It's just a matter of understanding the intelligence to surround yourself with the right environment, to take in the right amount of information, and the self-discipline and work ethic to put it into action where you're going over and over and over again. And the best guys are instinctual. The Fairtex,
Yotsenklai?
Yeah, Yotsenklai. I mean, he's the best in the world, right?
He was at one point. He's in like one now. Like I think he might be coming down, but he built a good name internationally for like the bigger fighters at his class. Right. Yeah.
So just him as an example.
Seems like Bolkow. That guy
and Bolkow is another example. Those guys, I mean, that's like literally a fish in water. They're fighting. When they're fighting, it's like it's impressive because they do everything right. You know, every step, et cetera, et cetera. And those kind of levels of skill set are some things that we see in the gym. You know, we have Lee Kemp, who's been a coach on our team. I just ran into him yesterday, actually. And that guy, when I asked him, what's the number one lesson you would tell these guys? He said, full-on commitment. He made a decision and outworked guys and became obsessed with something. And the work ethic on top of the drive was second to none. And so what I take from that Thai culture is, look, whatever the circumstance, the guys that actually rose to the top, the ones that end up rising to the top are literally all in. Now, why they're all in, that's a different story. I don't wish that on anybody, to be honest.
Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah, I really don't. Yeah, I'd rather be here in America where, you know, you get unemployment if you need to. And
you have a 401k.
Yeah, 401k and whatnot. But, you know, that lesson, I hope somebody out there this resonates with and says, you know what? I'm gonna put myself back a notch. I'm gonna live below my means. And
yeah.
I'm gonna make life a little bit harder for the bigger picture of things, mm-hmm. for the better life, because I know I've done that. I've done that in the past. You know, even someone like you coming across from the other side of the world and being in a new environment, and deciding to stick around because you liked the vibe or it was something that you saw for your future. I mean, that's a powerful thing. We see it time and time again. Song Yadong came when he was, I think, 18 years old,
yeah,
on a vacation out by himself. Cora McKenna came when she was 16 years old, on her own. You know, that's some gutsy stuff for a bigger picture, and anybody can do it when you decide to commit to something, and you understand that that's really what it takes is a full on commitment, and there's a fine line between people that post on Instagram about it and Facebook
want to do it,
and then people that are doing it most of the time, like Kaleo Romero is a good example of this. If I go look at his Instagram, it's the same thing over and over again. It's him training and training and training and training and training.
I remember seeing that guy hobbling along in crutches when he did his knee. And I was like, he's on the bag somehow.
He had like a hole in his toe. I'm like, man, I think that might be infected. He goes, I think it's all right, man. I go, bro, your toe's about to fall off. You need to take a break.
Yeah.
All right, Faber. Comes back and he's just got like
taped up
and shoved some cloth in it, you know. Be smart, guys, but hopefully you get obsessed. If not, find those other pieces, the work ethic, the discipline, the intelligence to surround yourself with the right people, and find your niche. All right, guys, until next time, MMAU.